A community that knows itself takes care of itself. The stories of those who live in the Matsu Borough are as varied as the people themselves. Some you have heard. Some, perhaps, you have not. This is Voices of the Matsu, bringing our stories to life.
Hi, I'm Emily Forstner, your host today with Voices of the Matsu. Throughout this program, we talk a lot about community, the what's, the where's, the who's and why's of those smaller groups within our community. And today we connect with another, a community that is wrestling with their role in very painful acts of racism. And within that community, the lasting impact it has had on one man's understanding of reconciliation. This episode is called The Apology. But it's not just about saying sorry. It's about how bearing witness bears responsibility.
My name is Tim Carrick. I'm a pastor at the United Protestant Presbyterian Church here in Palmer.
We've heard that there's always two sides to a story, but you know, that's not true. There's lots more than two sides. Every person involved has their side to a story, and every time a story is shared, a new perspective is added. So no, there are never just two sides to a story. In today's story, generations of people own it. Persons far from the Matsu. What do you do, though, when the story doesn't involve you directly, but involves the very institution that has defined your entire life?
Put a huge amount of damage just within one generation. And the Presbyterians are involved in that. And so the Presbyterian denomination is aware that our hands are bloody and we need to understand that we just can't move forward without finding reconciliation for the past.
I go to the church to meet Tim in his office. It reminds me of an oversized closet with a window. It's more of a library than an office. Books and papers line the walls, shelves, even the floor. Tim speaks with a soft-spoken tone, and maybe you'll agree. There seems to be always a thoughtful pause threaded between his words.
In our denomination, if things are working well, the local congregation is the one that calls the pastor. And so if the local congregation would like to keep the pastor and the pastor wants to stay, then we can stay as long as we want.
Tim's been the pastor of the United Protestant Presbyterian Church in Palmer for 32 years.
Still is like the average 7 or 8 years, something like that. But occasionally, people stay longer. My grandfather was a pastor at a church in San Francisco for 33 years. And my great-grandfather was a pastor of a church in Oregon for 28 years. And my parents were missionaries for 40 years.
For Tim, ministry is kind of a longevity thing.
I was born in Tokyo. I lived in Hamamatsu till I was 7, and from then until I came to America at 18, I was living in Kobe.
A very important side to the story today is the Presbyterian denomination of churches.
Quite often, denominations got their start in specific countries in Europe, and then when they came here, they continued their national churches, and the Presbyterians were the Church of Scotland. And Presbyterian essentially just describes a form of government, that it's presbyter.
Presbyter comes from the Greek word for elder. It's just that elders are the ones who are elected for roles and offices within the church.
The U.S. government system is modeled on the Presbyterian system. No one person has all the power.
It might interest you that the Palmer Church, though, has not always been part of the Presbyterian denomination.
It's that when the colony was settled here, that block of land was set aside for the church because there was kind of an idealism there that they could just have one church for the colony, but there was enough Catholics for a Catholic church, enough Lutherans for a Lutheran church. And so they created the United Protestant Church.
Huh. How about that? I've never considered a church as being something of a leftover.
Back then, there was all the denominations had mission agencies, and they got together somewhere on the East Coast and said, you know, okay, Presbyterians, you've got this one.
And that's a story of how the Church of a Thousand Logs was finished and remains today on the corner of Fireweed and Denali. But that's just part of the story. And this story has stories within stories. It's a regular matryoshka, the stacking peasant dolls from Eastern Europe. So excuse me while the story now takes us away from Palmer and Tim to another Presbyterian church in Southeast Alaska. It's 1940. Alaska's a territory, World War II is in progress, and racism in the Southeast is normal.
The grocery store, natives were only allowed to come in one day a week. The restaurants had signs that say, no natives and no dogs.
And it is when Dr. Walter Sobolov, a Tlingit of the Raven Dog Salmon Clan, returns to Alaska in Juneau. He's earned his master's in divinity from the University of Dubuque in Iowa, and he is the first Alaska native to be an ordained Presbyterian minister. He and his wife Genevieve start Memorial Presbyterian.
It was a very successful, thriving congregation. And there were white people that were in the community too that asked to join, and the congregation welcomed them. So it really was integrated before anything else was allowed to be integrated.
It's 1963 now, right before the Civil Rights Act, and there are two Presbyterian churches in Juneau. One is the segregated white Northern Light Presbyterian Church, and the other one is Walter Sobolov's Alaska Natives Memorial Presbyterian Church.
The white church was not integrated. This one was. And it had they had social services, they had youth programs, they had language programs, they had all kinds of things.
The Memorial Church is thriving. The white Northern Light Presbyterian Church, not so much. And it decides it needs to build a new church. So it asks the larger denomination for a loan.
And so the denomination felt like, well, let's just merge the two churches. Because integration was starting to become a reality in the 60s, at least an awareness of it. So they decided, without telling anyone, the denominational mission people, to close the native church and just assume that they'll all go over to the struggling other church.
The problem was that in this democratically run denomination, the Memorial Church was basically left out of the discussion.
It came as a complete shock. No one really explained what had happened. They just came and said, well, we're closing this church now. And it stunned the congregation. Just understand, like a year before, they had done a big fundraiser and got new pews even for the church. And so they just arbitrarily closed it.
The presbytery then assigned Walter Sobolov to be the traveling Presbyterian minister to the outlying villages.
At the Northern Lights Church, which now was supposed to have both congregations in there, the pastor left within a couple months of that, and they didn't call Walter Sobolov. They brought in a new white pastor. So there was a lot of pain and betrayal.
And that would have been the end of the story. Except in 2015, a committee at the Northern Light Church started looking through some old photos.
And then there were some people at the Northern Lights Church that were doing some homework on the history of their congregation, and they were looking back through records, and they ran across this and were shocked, you know, because now, you know, 50 years later, you see things differently. And so they started exploring and found out the history that went on.
What's called an overture was written to the General Assembly of the denomination to make an apology and reparations to the former members of the Memorial Church and to Walter Sobolov's family.
It went to the denomination and went through their committee structure, because Presbyterians are into committees. It's part of our theology, actually. There's a belief that no one person has a monopoly on the Holy Spirit, and so we trust that at least a majority of us are hearing what we need to hear. So it went through the committee structure and then went to the denominational floor. It was approved, I think, without any changes. which is pretty rare in the denomination.
It's agreed to pay $950,000 in reparations for the pain and harm caused. And this is where the story comes back around to the United Protestant Presbyterian Church of 1,000 Trees in Palmer and its minister, because this church is part of the Yukon Presbytery.
So I went down on behalf of our presbytery to stand with them when they went through this process.
Tim was ready for the ceremony that took place over 3 days in October. He knew apologies would be heard and apologies would be accepted, but he wasn't quite prepared for the impact this would have on him.
It just made me super sad, for one thing, that we have to come to this, that we are at that point where our denomination has to apologize. This is serious business. When Sasha Sobolev was accepting the apology, he stopped a moment and said, he was choking up. He says, "This is the first time I have cried since that happened." And I thought, people do carry a lot of pain. The other thing too is that I've heard a lot of pain from a lot of people I've known in our presbytery too.
I asked him, how important is a ceremony? Could apology and reparation be made without a carefully choreographed ceremony?
I think human beings are so geared towards ceremony. Every culture has ceremonies, and we do that all kinds of different ways. And then when you go visit another people's somewhere else, what they want to show you is the ceremonies. Then in a ceremony also you have those who are the leaders who are from different places to be able to speak on behalf of this person and that. But you also have all the witnesses, and the church was crowded, with all these people. So you have witnesses to the ceremony, and that's important as well. If they hadn't been to the ceremony, they don't know that Memorial Church had been closed, and that they wouldn't have known. A lot of the average people wouldn't know that. But I would still hope that every time you can take away some of the traumas that peoples live in, then the society just will become better.
Understandable. There's hope in asking for forgiveness and hope in being forgiven. But how do you forgive an organization?
Yeah, that's a process, isn't it? We might feel like we are doing this apology and it will help those people who had been hurt in some way. It could be that whole generation of Native folks who had been put into the schools and were loss of culture and language. It could be for them. But I think almost more important is for the person giving the apology, because I think it's harder to give an apology than to receive one. I really think so, because it's hard for us to admit. It puts us in a weak spot, a vulnerable spot, to say that we have to say, "I'm sorry." Forgiveness is a process. It can take a long time of forgiving this bit of it, this bit of it, this bit of it. And hopefully in time, we will know that we have been forgiven.
The thing is, Tim says he's heard a lot of pain from people in his own presbytery. This region has 6 churches in the north that are predominantly Inupiaq, with 2 churches on St. Lawrence Island. So what Tim hears in Juneau triggers what he knows has happened in his presbytery as well, which has had a couple of its own apologies.
Back in 2012, our presbytery went out to the city of Gamble, which is St. Lawrence Island, just right across from Russia, and had the same kind of a thing, an apology for our Presbytery's involvement in the school fiasco of taking families, kids away, even elementary kids away from their parents and being punished if they, for almost anything, but especially if they spoke any of their native language. So it's just killing a language, killing a culture.
Granted, though, it wasn't Tim who created this discrimination.
That's true, but but I also represent our denomination locally, and if our denomination has things that we need to apologize for, then it's our generation that's doing that. And I guess the thing that really affected me on the weekend was knowing that the people who set a lot of these systems in place probably really were thinking that they were doing the right thing. And kind of blind to things that are obvious to us now. And I guess the thing that I struggle with is, what, if anything, our generation is doing that my children's generation are going to need to be apologizing for. And I know, you know, we probably couldn't get into all these, you can't move forward if all you're doing is apologizing for the past, but part of reconciliation, which the church really should be part of our motto, reconciliation, involves recognizing stuff and not just quietly ignoring.
Remember, Tim's a fourth-generation pastor. And when he says he thinks back in time, particularly in the lower 48, when the American Indians were placed on reservations, and there was starvation, and a lot was not anywhere near good. But he says the liberals of the time, the real social action folks, they wanted to help the American Indians. They wanted to help them integrate so they could survive and do well. They really believed that. And then to realize, generations later, it was just the opposite. There was more harm than good. Tim says it's something like being an inheritor. He represents the present-day denomination as well as the mistakes of the past.
When I went to seminary and people knew that I was planning to be a pastor someday, I kept getting asked if I would ever go back to Japan as a missionary. And I said, no, absolutely not. I don't want to do that. And the reason why I felt that is that I felt I saw in way too many missionaries a kind of looking down on a condescending approach to those people, so to speak. And that infuriated me because you could see it. What I don't know is, you know, I'd be blind to my own parents' things. I'm assuming that they weren't like that. My parents both learned the language very well, learned to read it and write it. But I did know plenty of missionaries and particularly missionary wives that refused to really associate with the local folks, and that just bugged me so much.
You might be wondering, because I was, how does being something like a fly on the wall, so to speak, during the apology in Juneau, miles away from his own congregation, how did this story, as stories often do, become part of his? Well, for one thing, Tim says he listens and he speaks differently now.
Just like Sheldon Jackson and S. Hall Young and some of this kind of stuff. And then over the last 32 years, it's just I've been saying, you know, wait a second, you know, they really weren't that wonderful heroes. And then you know, in time, I don't know at what point I just shifted and thought, oh my, we do have a bad legacy.
The story that happens in Juneau may not have a direct connection with Tim, but it does make him consider his day-to-day behavior.
Then also the people who come in the doors. We do have, you know, we're in downtown Palmer, and we have sometimes people who have no place to live, coming in to warm up or do something. And I catch myself making judgments right off the bat, kind of making excuses for them or whatever, you know. Well, he's got mental illness or he's on drugs or something like that. And so in a way, I'm also putting them in a box and saying, okay, you're different. But, you know, you can come here and use the bathroom and get a hot cup of tea and stuff like that. But do I reach out and look at them as part of the family as the same way I do other people? And it is, it's different. I do. I find myself putting people into categories, whether they are in or out.
The story rearranges things in a way.
And so it's, you know, basically fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of the outside group, the people who are not part of my inner group. And so I think what's changed me in this thing is when I meet people who are in my outside group, I try to be conscious of that and try to understand why. I may never know why, but I just try.
I recently listened to a TED Talk by Shantar Vedantam. He's from the podcast Hidden Brain. It's a really good podcast if you're not familiar. This TED Talk, though, is called You Don't Actually Know What Your Future Self Wants. In it, Shantar says it's foolish to think our future selves will share the same views, perspectives, or hopes of our current selves. It's just too much in between the two. But what we can do, and he walks you through this during the podcast, is to stay curious. Be humble when things change. And here's a clincher. Be brave. So how does that organization we met earlier, a religious denomination with committees and elders, and even leftovers built with 1,000 trees, face its future self?
Kind of repent for how we've done it in the past. So the belief is, especially in the Christian church, that forgiveness and reconciliation are so, so important. But yet we, you know, it's hard to put that into practice as a, I mean, it's one thing if you're an individual, you do that, you can do that. I can choose to do that with you if I had an issue and we can reconcile, I can repent, there can be forgiveness. But how does an organization do that, you know?
Easier said than done.
Because, you know, just because a denomination made that doesn't mean that every member of the denomination agrees with it. I'm sure that there are some that say, you know, we shouldn't, you know, shouldn't be bothering doing that. Let's just move forward. You know, just leave the past to the past. There's also the feeling of, like with reparations, that if you give reparations to the descendants, are you, you know, there's a feeling like you're really not helping out the people you actually hurt, although the generations can be still experiencing hurt and the trauma from generations before. So in a way, it's appropriate.
The bottom line for Tim?
In order to move into the future, we need to address the past and you know, we can't change the past, but we can accept responsibility for the past and then try to move on. There's still an awful lot in which we categorize and lump people into a them, defining us based on what we're comfortable with and what how we want our own image to be. Anytime I think we create an us and them, we're building a wall and not bridges.
But really, Tim, we can't go on asking forgiveness for everything done wrong. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be doing anything except groveling for the rest of my life.
And you can go, you can just keep going further and further back and unpacking, and then who apologizes for, you know, the Crusades and the Inquisitions,
yeah,
and things like that. But this is one of those areas where I can. I am part of a community that can apologize for things that have happened on my parents' generation guard, my grandparents' generation guard, when rather than helping people to become fully who they were called to be, we put huge limitations on them by sequestering them or changing them to become like us.
One word I asked him, just one word to describe that intersection of stories between what happened in Juneau and the Church of a Thousand Trees in Palmer, and once again, connecting with his own story, just one word. But he can't think of just one word. He has three. And it reminds me of that podcast about the future self, about being curious.
Kind of a relief that it's not something under the rug. It's like it's kind of like relief that it is being addressed and we can move forward. So relief would be there.
And humility.
Kind of a sadness that there is so much of that, so much hurt, and so many people broken because of the actions. It could even have been good intentions of others. So I came with tears in my heart.
And he ends with, "Be not afraid."
Well, that's almost the most quoted thing. I mean, every time God or a representative of God was speaking to the people, even to Mary, "Don't be afraid," to the angels, "Don't be afraid." Because fear is really the opposite of faith.
The story began with a grief observed, a grief created by blind racism. And that story creates a ripple effect, one of self-reflection and change, miles and miles away. And that is what a many-sided good story does.
I'm a pastor. I have a congregation that I've been in love with for 32 years. And it makes me mindful of everyone who is there. Because, we're all carrying hurts. And we're all carrying something that we might not even be able to recognize where our needs for forgiveness might be, our needs for reconciliation. But everybody's carrying a story.
Indeed, Tim, it's a new year. What stories will we be curious enough to know this year, humble enough to hear, and brave enough to change? That's it for today's episode of Voices of the Mat-Su. Here at KVRF Big Cabbage Radio, we wish you all a happy new year. If you have a story or know of someone who does, contact us at voices@bigcabbageradio.org. Until next time, it's been nice getting to know each other a little bit more. Special thanks to my family and the KVRF editorial board for their guidance and support. In footnote, Dr. Walter Sobolov continued as a traveling minister, as well as starting the Alaska Native Studies program at UAF, and leadership in the Alaska Native Brotherhood. He died at the age of 102. Those interested in knowing more about the apology and reparations to the Northern Light United Church can go to khnluc.org. Thanks for listening. Stay good out there, Mat-Su.
This was Voices of the Mat-Su, sharing stories told by those who live in the Mat-Su borough. To revisit this and past stories, go to bigcabbageradio.org. This project is funded by a grant from the Mat-Su Health Foundation and is produced by Emily Forstner for Big Cabbage Radio. The views expressed in Voices of the Mat-Su do not represent the views of Big Cabbage Radio or the Mat-Su Health Foundation. Comments or questions about this show may be sent to voices@bigcabbageradio.org.